The whole world is holding its breath right now, including me. What they're doing right now is they're blocking all outflows from Iran. If you cut off the outflow, then the oil infrastructure that Iran has will actually explode from within. And so I think it's a waiting game right now.
Dr. Jeff Ross is a former diagnostic radiologist turned hedge fund manager who reads markets like medical scans, spotting patterns others miss.
He brings a rare mix of macro, Bitcoin, geopolitics, and risk thinking to help investors separate signal from noise.
The price of Bitcoin is in a very strong, it's called a bear flag technical pattern. The most likely next move for Bitcoin is a move lower. I think liquidity can't be in two places at once. When the liquidity shifts from being funneled into the stock market to being funneled into the real economy, as Michael Howell talks about, you generally see a weak.
Hey guys, don't skip this part. There's something for you to win here. We're running a 21-day sprint and giving away 3 signed copies of our Bitcoin book to listeners who help grow the show on Fountain. There are 3 ways to win. Either become the top supporter and cumulative sats zapped over this 21-day period, or provide the most Bitcoin-like zap, meaning you don't just zap big, but in style. Or last but not least, create the most amount of valuable content around any episode during this 21-day period on either X or Noster. Provided you are a subscriber to the show on Fountain, have reposted the sprint post on Noster or X, and emerge as the leader in any of the categories mentioned above, you'll be the proud owner of a new Bitcoin book in no time. We'll share an update of the leaderboard on each show during the campaign. Good luck. And now on to today's show. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. Today joining me is Jeff Ross out of the United States. Cool to have you with us, Jeff.
Thanks so much for having me, Pascal. It's really nice to be on your show.
Yes, finally. I wanted to get you on. I meant to get you on for quite some time, but then I always figured it's kind of hard to connect with you because I think you kind of withdrew from social media, I guess, also. Mm-hmm. And so it was hard getting a hold of you, but now finally I managed, and it's great to have brought you on. So yeah, maybe if you could quickly introduce yourself to the people maybe out of Europe and Switzerland who listen to my show and don't know you, and then also... yeah, what's up with social media? Why are you kind of withdrawing? And yeah, that would be great to kind of start things off.
Sure. I'll start with that. The second question first. So a couple of years ago, I made the decision to shut down all of my social media accounts except Noster. And so I went Noster only. I can't remember, maybe a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, somewhere around there. That was great. The hardest part for me was shutting down Twitter because I was pretty addicted to Twitter. And, you know, why do I do? I don't, you know, some people kind of proselytize about that. I don't care what people do. But for me personally, it just had become consuming and unhealthy. And I noticed that the more social media I used, kind of the worse mood I was in. I tended to be a doom scroller. You know, I focus on things that concerned me. And so I just thought, you know what, I don't need this in my life. And so I focus mostly on Noster. But then even with Noster, I love Noster. I think if people are going to use social media, that should be their number one go-to app or protocol, I should say. Even Noster, it started out great, I think, where it was just like honest people having kind of honest discussions and bouncing ideas off of each other. But now it's full of bots and it's full of nonsense and it's full of angry people and people yelling at each other. And it's all of this stuff that like just kind of bothers me. And I just think, you know what, I'm getting kind of old now. I got other things in my life and I don't need to be spending my time doing so much social media. So that's the long answer for why I dropped it. All I have now is this new Substack newsletter that I started. I've been impressed with Substack. It's kind of how Noster was actually in its earlier days, where it was just like people bouncing ideas off of each other and having honest discussions about the world. And the stuff I like, you know, I like to talk about macro. I like thinking about geopolitics, and I run a hedge fund. And so I'll go back to my story, like how I got to who I am and how I got to be where I am. Way back in the 1990s, when I was at college, I had two passions. I had a passion for wanting to become a doctor and passion for wanting to work in finance. I've always been kind of a numbers guy and have enjoyed that field. I decided to become a doctor. And so the way that works is I then spent about the next 15 years of my life going down that path. And when I finally came out of training in 2008, which that was a long gap, about 15 years, where all I did was focus on medicine and becoming a doctor. Then I kind of got the rest of my life back a little bit. I started working full time as a doctor, but then on the side, I started up a newsletter, like a blog, where I was just sort of sharing with people how I invest and how I think about investing. I early on got picked up by The Motley Fool, and started writing for them and for Seeking Alpha. Developed enough of an audience way back then that people asked me if I would invest money on their behalf. And I was like, oh, I'm just a doctor and I just write these newsletter things for fun. But anyways, it put an idea in my head that maybe I should think about doing that. And so, without getting into too much detail, I decided to start at my hedge fund. I started running that in 2014. So that's been going for about 12 years now. I got to the point where being a doctor and running my financial business got to be so busy. I did basically these multiple careers for about 11 years, that I finally just decided I'm going to go all in on my hedge fund and, not do the doctor thing anymore. Cause it just got to be too much.
Yeah.
And where the overlap is real quick is as a macro fund manager is very similar to being a diagnostic radiologist, where you're focusing on patterns and pattern recognition, and you look at the big picture and you make a diagnosis. And so it's very similar, the two things. A lot of people don't see the correlation, but for me, it's very similar. It's kind of like the same reason why a lot of engineers become prominent investors or prominent Bitcoiners, is they see these patterns and they understand how the system works. And then it just makes a lot of sense to them. So that's kind of the angle I approach investing at.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, definitely. That's definitely interesting from what I hear other people say, exactly. Engineers and just people who have sort of gotten used to numbers and like deeper analysis, and then pattern recognition, as you said, it's something you can figure out. And then there's obviously a lot of overlap. Maybe later on, I have some more questions on this, but I just wanted to quickly come back to the thing with the social media, because I feel like a lot of people in the audience, I guess, can feel this, and feel like similarly and feel like, okay, social media doesn't do me any good. It makes me into a worse person in that sense. But then, I have this feeling on the one side as well. But then on the other hand, I'm like, I'm personally like now also writing, as you do. I get a lot of my information from X, from like the inspiration. Like if I had to weigh these two things, I sometimes feel like, yeah, there's also a lot of con or like pros in it, vis-a-vis the cons. So like, where do you get your information from? And like, how do you deal with like getting new insights,
That was the hardest part for me, is because I got all of my real time news and information from Twitter, basically from X. And so that was the biggest transition problem for me. But what comes with that news is all of the gossip and all of the doom scrolling and all of this other stuff and the programming by the algorithms to push you down different routes, which I couldn't stand. What I do is I have alternative news sources. Like I'll use Google News Feed, and I basically, the way I like to do things is I like to see every angle of the news. Like I don't look just to the, what do the Republican news outlets think, or what do the Democrat news think, or what does American news outlets think? I like to look at, the US, and I like to look at European views, and I like to look at the Middle Eastern views and Chinese views of what is going on. Because when you look at a certain news event that's going on, depending on what news outlet you read, I know you know this and everybody knows this, but there's so much bias in any news source that you read. I spend my days going through looking at each sort of topic that is important to me, but from all of these different angles. And then if you get everybody's different pieces and different angles, you can usually kind of figure out what's going on. You can get a little bit closer to the truth. But it took a while for me to build that up and to learn how to acquire news outside of social media was pretty tough. But I will just say that I've been a happier person in general. I'm more focused on the people around me in my life versus the online people. And so it's been healthy for me.
Yeah, I totally subscribe to this. I would think the same would probably happen to a lot of people. And I would think it's just a trade-off for me as well. You know, at some point, I feel like I want to go back to this older life, you know, because like you're right. Social media, it's just probably by definition, you know, it's kind of hard to filter out all the noise because even as you said with Nostr, you know, and maybe with Substack, it just feels like this by now. But then once the crowd has discovered Substack and now also with AI slop, and everyone wants to come up with content, you know, then at some point it might just be the same old thing all over again. And so for me, it's still like, if somebody figures this out, you know, how to get like a social media, how to get your news on a daily basis, very highly curated, but then without the noise, to me, that would be another $1 trillion opportunity. But then, you know, once like every $1 trillion opportunity will kind of morph into something bad further down the line. It's probably just human fate at this point in time. But it's a quest that everyone,
right. And it's an issue. And, you know, I'm old enough that I grew up, you know, I'm in, you know, the last century where we used to have junk. For every mail, there's junk mail. And for email, there's spam, right? And for social media, there's all the bots. And there's noise everywhere. That's why I love the name of your show, by the way, right? And, you know, you're looking for the signal and in the middle of all the noise, and it's very difficult to do that. But the one thing you can do, and I'm sure, and I know you've learned how to do this too, is just you can curate your feed so that you're at least learning from people or talking to people who provide actual signal. Yeah. And if you do that, you can filter out quite a bit of the noise. And so,
exactly.
Yeah, I think we're all kind of, those of us who are looking for the truth spend a lot of time curating our feeds.
Exactly. That's something that never really occurred to me, but just like in recent weeks, even like I've been doing it like, or months, I would say I've been doing it regularly, you know, like really curating and doing some proper hygiene with the people. And then sometimes I really, I scale it down to a couple of 100 people, you know, which mm-hmm. I feel like, okay, this is still worth it. But then this is, yeah, it's actual work again, you know, it's not just something you can kind of or have things rain at you, because then again, it's just consuming. And if you do the curating and stuff like this, it feels a little more like work. And then maybe there's also some more, like I would say, destiny in it, or what would I say, you know, like you feel like, okay, there's something worth in it, you know. But yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you can find value in it.
Value, exactly.
Finally, yeah. But you got to put the work in to get the value, like most things in life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, no, that's great for starters. Maybe we can move over to your Substack, given we've already referenced it. You know, like I was quite intrigued by your latest Substack. It was greatly written, very, very nice. Mm-hmm. And also the way you deal with these several signals, you know, which are sort of converging, and the title is even signals converging. So could you take us through what type of signals you were looking at, and then also what are these signals right now telling you?
Sure. I'll start out with the one that has sort of the least signal, or the least of a trend, but that's the trend in and of itself. So that's the US dollar. The US dollar has been chopping sideways for over a year now. It's been range bound basically between like 101.5 and like 96.5 or something. Let me look to make sure I'm accurate. Yeah, about 95, 96 range. And it's been just sort of chopping in that pattern. I call those crab markets. So when things just go like this sideways, Bitcoin has crab markets sometime that drive people nuts. So the dollar is doing that right now. There's not, so calling a direction is basically impossible. And the reason why it's chopping sideways is because the markets don't know what to think right now. So Trump mm-hmm. is very confusing for markets, right? Because he can lead us in one direction, and then literally one truth post later, the markets all move in a different direction. And I think he kind of likes to have that. And they use that to their advantage, the mm-hmm. Trump administration, right? They're using social media, they're using opinion polls and things like that. And so they have a very powerful effect on the market. When the dollar strengthens, as everybody knows, it's called the dollar wrecking ball. It tends to be very difficult on risk assets. tends to be difficult on Bitcoin. It hurts the price in the near term, those kind of things. And when the dollar is weakening, it has the opposite effect. Risk assets tend to do pretty well. Bitcoin tends to do pretty well. So that's the dollar. So do I have a specific call on the dollar? No, not until we have some sort of resolution with where we are currently. So this war in the Persian Gulf, which I'm sure we'll talk more about later. Basically, everything just sort of depends on what happens and the decisions that the Trump administration makes. And, you know, we're recording this Monday morning here, U.S. time. And I believe actually the Trump cabinet is meeting right now, discussing what to do, what their next steps should be. So we'll see. So that was the one kind of just random signal that I noticed. Okay, the dollar is chopping sideways. What gets more important?
Maybe just one thing to chime in here, you know, because you wrote in the article, I'm totally with you on that. You know, it's quite hard to read the direction of where the dollar is going. We'll go just because, like, as you said, you know, we don't know Trump's next move. But then there is this these technical indicators, you know, you mentioned it as well, the SMA, you know, 200 day, which is kind of, yep, for whatever reason, important, like all different momentum people are looking at this. And it's currently fighting to hold this. It feels like, you know, couldn't that be sort of an indication, if it were to hold it, that then, you know, it could be bullish, or if not, it's not. And what would you be looking for? Like, would it have to hold for a couple of days or weeks, or like, yeah, how do you think about this? Obviously,
right,
it's a time frame.
So the 200 day, sure. So the 200 day moving average, simple moving average, usually is what people use, is generally the most important long-term indicator that momentum traders or investors will use. Mm-hmm. Right now, what's happening is that 200-day moving average it looks like a flat horizontal line, and the price of the dollar is just doing this. So it's chopping up and down, up and down. It's chopping people up. Day traders love that because they scalp it. They try to, you know, they buy it down here, they sell it up here, and they just repeat. The pattern to take from that is, again, what we were talking about. It's this choppy, sideways, crab-like pattern. Where it's not picking a direction. And so, like, even this morning, it started the day where the dollar was spiking and it looked like it was really holding this 200-day moving average trend. And then, like, intraday, just a couple hours ago, it just plummeted and fell below the 200-day moving average. And so, again, that's just the market uncertainty. And the markets want to pick a direction, but they don't know what direction to pick because there's so much uncertainty with what's going on in the Persian Gulf. And I watch, like I said earlier, regarding news sources, right? So I'm watching different news sources interpret what's happening right now in the Persian Gulf and with Trump. Some people are saying he's being humiliated and getting crushed and losing this war. Other people say he's just, you know, playing 4D chess and he's got it all under control. And the truth is probably somewhere in between. You know, I said on Danny's show on What Bitcoin Did a week and a half ago that I would be surprised if the U.S. hadn't landed on Karg Island and started to take, and I don't know how much you've thought about or talked about that or anything, but it's the main exporting hub for the oil that comes out of Iran. They run pipes underneath in the Persian Gulf, and they basically fill up Karg Island and then they export from there. Mm. So we've had this. So my interpretation of events leading for over the last week and the last 2 weeks was that we were setting everything up. We were getting all of our military in place in order to make a move for Karg Island to basically take it over and remove the hold of Iran on Karg Island and basically control their flows of oil and therefore control the movements of their regime. I was surprised. I said I would be surprised if we didn't make a move for it by it was actually by last Friday, so the 24th of April. But what we're doing instead, and I don't know if the U.S. Planned on this or it was just like a fortuitous thing that they discovered when they set up this blockade. Basically, it looks like what they're doing right now is they're blocking all outflows from Iran, right? And the world all understands that. But what's happening is all of the reserves of Iran for their oil that's still flowing in, it's still flowing from their wells into Karg Island and into these, you know, random containers that they have, they're all filling up and they're almost full right now. And so when Trump alluded to this just yesterday in a news conference, he basically said, if you cut off the outflow, then the oil infrastructure that Iran has will actually explode from within. It'll actually die from within and be unrecoverable. And so the way I look at this as a doctor, the way to think about this, so you have your heart pumping, right? It's pumping blood. and it comes out of the aorta in your chest. So right about here, if you took the aorta and you squeezed it and clamped it shut, your heart would keep pumping and it would, and the pressure would build and build and build, and it would eventually explode. It could rupture or it would just seize. It would give up and you would have a heart attack and you would die. Either way, it's going to be a bad outcome if you block the outflow. And so that's what the US, I think, is doing right now, is we're blocking all of the outflow and causing the Iranian oil infrastructure to basically implode from the inside out. And so I think it's a waiting game right now between the Trump administration and the IRGC, who's in control. So that's my take on it right now. The markets are waiting to see what the outcome will be, and we'll know what the outcome is based on the movement of the dollar and the movement of oil over the coming several days, I think.
Yeah, that's a very interesting analogy, and I feel like I've heard it here for the first time, but it makes a lot of sense, you know, that they're trying to use this as a sort of choke point, and then, yeah, as you said, they're trying to build up the pressure, and at some point they will just implode, you know, because like it's overflowing in that sense, you know, and it's also, if they can't sell it to anyone else, then also, yeah, they're not making any revenue off of this. But like, yep. Where would you see then, if this strategy by the US all adds up, you know, and they manage to kind of bring Iran to its knees, and then they have dominion over it in that sense, where would that put the dollar then? Would the dollar kind of go down as a release wealth, or would it strengthen? Like, yeah, how do you think about this?
So we'll find out. So what's happening is, I think there's this big collision. It's a game of chicken. I don't know if you're familiar with that in Switzerland, but we call that chicken when, you know, you're having these two forces moving at each other really fast, and somebody is going to flinch, but we don't know who's going to flinch first. The other thing that the Trump administration has going against them is Trump started this war about, I think, 58 days ago. And the war power resolution that exists right now is, it gives the president 60 days to basically do these actions without having congressional approval. And that expires on Wednesday, April 29th. So we're, as the time of this recording, we're 2 days away from that. So Trump, if this continues until Wednesday and then beyond, he has to get permission from Congress or has to come up with some other move in order to keep it going. So that's very interesting too. So we don't know what's going to happen. And I think the IRGC on the Iranian side knows that as well. And they know if they can just outlast Trump and outlast this blockade, we might implode from a government perspective from the inside over here in the United States. And so it's super interesting. And I would just say that the markets don't seem to know what to make of it at the moment. So we'll see how it resolves in the next few days, I think.
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes.
Okay, I didn't know about this congressional thing that he also needs to kind of bring them on board after this. That's also interesting. I've never heard about this. Yeah, I mean, I just feel like, okay, yeah, what will happen to the dollar? That's really decisive, you know. And just like, I would have thought in a crisis scenario as we are right now, the dollar would strengthen even further. But it hasn't to some extent. And then at some point, I also feel like Trump, he kept repeatedly said he's not interested in having too high of a dollar, you know, because he wants to get it lower as well. And so, yeah, I'm still trying to put together all the pieces. What is he trying to engineer here, you know? But yeah, as you said, markets are indecisive as of now, yeah.
Yeah, and there's two sides to the war. So it's, even if the U.S. wants to do something and we have a very powerful military, there's a chance we won't succeed, and there's a chance we will flinch before the IRGC does. But there's, I think most people are banking on the IRGC being forced to flinch first. I don't know. So if this policy works, the tactics work on for the U.S., you know, I think we would see concessions by the IRGC. The U.S. would be sort of back in control of the flows, and the Strait of Hormuz would probably open up again under U.S. and kind of global control. I would expect, if that happens, that the dollar would weaken and that risk assets would do quite a bit better, that rates would come down and that oil prices would come down, right? That would be sort of the release valve. But if this continues on and it starts to look kind of dicey for the United States, I expect the opposite to happen. I think the dollar will strengthen. People will sell risk assets. Bitcoin will probably come down a bit. I think oil will continue higher and might actually spike higher. So the whole world is holding its breath right now, including me. I'm just kind of watching to see what happens. It's really interesting.
It is very interesting. Like if you are like an observer from far away, obviously you said it on the show with Danny as well. I mean, war and everything that's happening is never something that we can cherish. But I feel like if you just objectively look at this, it's such an interesting period that we go through, and how to then kind of study markets and how they behave. Because like it is, as you said, it's this 4D, 5D chess that he's playing, you know, because like I guess his ultimate goal is going to be a lower dollar, but then also he doesn't want to lose, because then it might be opposite to his interest. So it's also probably way over our head in the end. It's so complex, you know, but we can only speculate and try to think through these things. I mean, that's one thing, the dollar, but then I think you had other points that you mentioned, other signals. Maybe we can
Talk about the converging. So the next two things I talked about were the Bitcoin price, that, and everybody is super interested in what the Bitcoin price is. I always like to caveat, like, I have no idea what the price is going to do, but here's what the signals look like at the moment. The first chart I showed, and that's, this chart still holds, it's the price of Bitcoin is in a very strong, it's called a bear flag technical pattern. And I know most Bitcoiners don't care at all about technicals, so this isn't for you. Most Bitcoiners should just simply, you know, dollar cost average, use it, treat it as your savings account. Don't trade Bitcoin. That's for fools. But for people who run funds and things, like I pay attention to these sorts of things. The reason why it matters, if people can like find my Substack and look at these charts, because I post them there now. But what happens is when you have a bear flag, you have a large drop in the price, and then they can make different things, but you have what's called a rising bearish channel. So a parallel channel where the price chops higher slowly over the ensuing weeks and even months. And then it eventually most likely breaks down. So that same exact thing happened to Bitcoin back. And basically it dropped hard until mid-November and then chopped in this bearish flag until kind of towards the mid to end of January of 2026. And then it plummeted all the way down to where it fell below 60,000 in early February. And now it's in another one of those bearish rising parallel channels. So a bear flag is what they call it. And it chops, chops, chops. And then why does that matter? And people think, oh, it's voodoo, it's horoscopes for men. They say all these kind of things. I get that. I think a lot of lines that people draw on charts are exactly the same. But why does that matter is that the people who have looked into this, the research shows that 65 to 70% of the time, it breaks down lower when you see this chart. And it's a very compelling chart. And I would say this is a textbook example of that chart right now. So 65 to 70% of the time, it breaks lower, and breaks lower like decisively. So I think it could fall like down into the $50,000 range, 50 to 60,000, somewhere in there. Which means, by the way, 30 to 35% of the time, so about a third of the time, it breaks to the upside. So it breaks that pattern to the upside. So none of this is a prediction. It's just a probability game. And that's what people get confused a lot. Like, I work in terms of probabilities. And I think, like, okay, if I have a 2/3 chance that something is going to happen, that's pretty good odds. So in general, you know, that's something you may or may not want to place a bet in. But that's how I think about things, is in terms of probabilities. So that's the setup I see. Okay. And that's still happening right now, by the way. That bearish channel that I talked about several days ago when I posted that is still in play right now. So Bitcoin, in order to break higher, has to go decisively above 80,000 in the next couple of days and then hold above 80,000. And it may or may not. I'm not saying it will or won't. I'm just saying that prediction wise, it has about a 1/3 chance of doing that. And then should I go on, just because part two of that is the liquidity framework. So Michael Howell, who I think does the best work on liquidity in the world, he has some very compelling charts where he has a chart, and I posted this in my newsletter, where he basically talks about global liquidity, advances it 13 weeks, and says you can kind of predict what Bitcoin is going to do based on these sort of price movements of global liquidity. And so what that shows, and I would say very clearly shows, is because liquidity has been slowing down, the rate of change has been slowing around the world, the most likely next move for Bitcoin is a move lower. So when I talk about signals converging, I take Michael Howell's liquidity framework plus these technical frameworks that I watch as well. And when they converge, I think that adds strength to the idea that the next move for Bitcoin could be lower.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what I found so interesting when I was reading your article. You're not just talking about the idiosyncratic reasons, like in terms of like Bitcoin, you know, the actual bear flag that a lot of people have pointed out as well. But then you hook it up with that analysis by Howell, you know, and it really adds up, and it paints a very intuitive picture, or tells a very like logical story to me, you know. And so I was really intrigued, and that's why I recommend everyone the checking this out. But then on the other hand, I mean usually if something sounds too good to be true, in the sense of like, now what like however you look at it, you know, if you want Bitcoin to go down, then it's actually too good to be true. But if not, then it's the other way around. But then, like, obviously I'm like, yeah, you said it about the probabilities as well, you know, which seem to be stacked against us in that sense. But then, you know, James Check from Check on Chain, you know, Nick Badio, all these people who are now great analysts. And I think sometimes we read each other and we write about these things. From what I gathered, all of them now have a similar view on okay, we're going down for one more leg, you know, lower. And so then again, I'm feeling almost like, oh, there's also consensus, which usually markets don't go the consensus way, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, we don't have a crystal ball, but I think things can still come or turn out the other way. That's for sure, right?
That's a super important point, is that most people, like, none of this, nobody should take any of this to mean this is a certainty, right? Yeah. Or a prediction. Like, we have no idea. And even though the odds are all in favor, like, you can have 90% odds that something is going to work, right? But it might be the 10% that happens. And so you're actually wrong and everybody's wrong. Like, that's just how the world works. And so you got to not think in terms of definitives. You have to think in terms of probabilities.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. But then we're back to like professional money managers. You know, if you're not a professional one, then you maybe don't have to go by these probabilities. But if you are on a fiduciary duty or whatever duty you have, you know, in vis-a-vis your clients, I mean, you have to stick to something, you know, and kind of, and you said it yourself. Some people say it's just voodoo, you know, that's why you don't even want to manage money. But like, if you're interested in that type of stuff, and I myself, I'm also a money manager, you know, for a private bank on the side. And so, yeah, we kind of have to think in probabilities. So maybe my question, if you could maybe talk a little bit about this without giving away your secret sauce, obviously, but how do you manage money? How do you, you said something about you're a momentum trader. How do you make sure you scale in before all of the momentum is already lost? Or like, yeah, how do you think about this?
Right. I mean, so ways to think about it as like a fund manager or as a hedge fund manager, however you want to do it. So you can hedge against this. So when it looks like lots of things are lining up and your probabilities are increasing of a short-term move, then obviously it's easy to hedge, right? Like, so people could buy puts if they wanted to. They could short things if they wanted to. They could do things to sort of protect a long position they have. Or maybe if they're waiting to start, establish a long position, maybe they would want to wait for a while, right? Or maybe put only half of their position in. There's just tons of things you can do. You can raise cash in order to hedge to the downside. And I definitely am not giving any recommendations in that, because, you know, these, I can't and I don't do that. But there are ways to think through this as a fund manager. And I will say that it's just so important to think. And have you read Annie Duke's book, Thinking in Bets? Or are you familiar with it?
I haven't. No, I haven't.
Okay. It's the same kind of concept. Like, basically she was a poker champion and wrote a whole book about how wise it is basically to think in bets. And even if the decision ends up being the wrong decision, like, say I say there's a 2/3 chance that the price is going to drop, but then it ends up going higher. It's not that your thinking was wrong. You might have done everything correctly, but it just, the way the world worked is it just the less likely chance actually ended up happening. And so you still can do things. You're still going to look like you're making mistakes and lose money, like, as a fund manager, even if you're doing everything correctly. And then vice versa, you can totally be guessing and do everything wrong, but still look right because the market moved in the direction that you were betting. And so she has a great framework, and I would recommend that people go ahead and read that book in terms of thinking in terms of probabilities. And if you do that enough times over a long time frame, in general, you're going to be right and you're going to be rewarded for that. But all along the way, you're going to get things wrong, even though you're doing the right thing. And so That's sort of a really a roundabout answer to what you're saying. I think it, you know, the right answer right now might be sure to hedge a little bit, to hedge against downside risk. Lots of different ways to do that, but that might turn out to be wrong, right? I mean, we might find out tomorrow or the next day that the war is over and whatever team won, and now oil is flowing again and risk assets are back and the bull market's back. And then it'll look like it was a dumb decision to hedge against it. So it's that's what makes everything so interesting.
Exactly. That's what makes things so interesting. And in the end, we all learn along the way, and, you know, and you have some more years, you know, to draw from. But yeah, exactly. I mean, in the end, it's also sort of judging from experience and bringing in statistics, as you said, you know, because in the long haul, statistics might be on your side, you know, and that's why it sort of works out. So because you know, I guess you're struggling with these questions from Bitcoiners as well. You know, you said it in the beginning, yeah, just do the DCA and stuff. And I feel like that's a very good decision for most people, but and even for us, I guess, in the end, because again, you know, as you said, it's clearly hard to do these type of things. But I just have this inner urge in me. I'm feeling drawn to these type of ideas and stuff to think about, you know, and so I can't help but try to do this at least with some money, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
It's tempting. It's hard for a guy. I don't know what it is about being male, but like there's just this desire to like to gamble and to win.
Probably.
And to, you know, but I don't know what it is. I think women generally have better mindsets towards long-term investing and just don't worry so much about the short-term price movements and predictions. And just if you see an asset you like, that's brilliant. That's the, you know, a great asset, like a Bitcoin or like stocks or whatever, like just buy it and hold it and don't worry so much about the price. That's the best advice overall.
Yeah, probably in the end it is. No, very, very interesting. I want to move on to maybe the real economy, you know, because you had this very interesting comment in this other podcast that you brought up as well, you know, that you said like you believe the real economy is turning to the better now. And I feel like a lot of people would be like, wow, okay, we're just coming out of this war. How can you say so? Like what kind of data points are telling you this? And yeah, if you could elaborate, that would be great.
Sure. So the thing I follow probably most closely is what is the ISM manufacturing PMI doing in the United States? So like, again, the US it's not the only economy, obviously, but it's a very important, it still drives kind of the global economy. Traditionally, when the US manufacturing PMI is rising and global liquidity is kind of simultaneously rising in the same direction, that's generally, historically speaking, really good for risk assets. So like NASDAQ stocks, tech stocks tend to do really well. Bitcoin tends to do really well. When you have these huge blow off tops in Bitcoin, it's usually when global liquidity is high and rising really fast, like it's accelerating to the upside and the economy is accelerating to the upside. So COVID kind of ruined everything. We used to have these really tight 4-year cycles where everything was just going swimmingly. And then along comes COVID, and not just COVID, but the government response to COVID has changed everything. It froze the, you know, the supply chains. They had this massive wave of fiscal and monetary stimulus. Then we had that huge spike in inflation, which is caused by both of these things. You had the monetary debasement, and then you also had the supply chains frozen, all that kind of stuff. So everybody knows about all that. And the way I look at that is it's sort of like if you have normal waves in a lake, and then somebody comes along and throws a huge boulder into the lake and it just distorts everything for a while. And that's COVID distorted everything for a while. And now the markets are trying to get back to their normal ebb and flow, like their sine wave that they normally flow in. The manufacturing PMI in the United States went into a contraction in 2022. And that was normal. That was kind of as expected. But what was abnormal is it didn't come out of that contractionary period all the way basically until this year. Mm-hmm. So we have not seen that post-World War II where it just didn't recover at all. It tried to a couple of times. It popped above 50. So above 50 is expansion. Below 50 is contraction. It's been basically in a contraction, except for a couple random months here and there, since 2022. what I look at now is basically the last 3 months of readings that have come out. It's finally above and holding above 50. So it's been in the 52 and a half sort of region. There's nothing magical about those numbers, but what it does say is that it's actually expanding for the first time since 2022. So that's very encouraging. What's unusual about it is normally you see this expansion kind of at around the same time frame or lagging a little bit global liquidity. So you usually see liquidity spike, and Michael Howell will talk about this, and then you see the manufacturing sector spike. What had been happening is we had liquidity spiking over the last couple of years, but manufacturing was languishing. And so now liquidity looks like it's rolling over, but manufacturing is coming up now, which is interesting. And so one of the things that I look at and to explain that is because the US government has decided that there is basically nothing more important than AI and building data centers and rebuilding the military industrial complex. So the Trump administration is in war mode. They're talking like we're back in World War II, like this is World War III. Trump is signing executive orders, basically taking over industries and funneling. And so why this matters as an investor is there's this thing I like to call the liquidity blob. So the liquidity blob is how big is this huge blob of money that's just sort of sitting around that can go move in different directions? And where is the liquidity blob? Is it sitting in the government? Like when the government collects tax receipts, the money is moving from the people into the government. Mm. Or when the government borrows a crazy amount of money, they're asking the public for money. So they issue a ton of treasuries and the liquidity flows from the people and from the markets to the liquidity blob that's hovering over the government. But the government currently right now is they're doing massive fiscal spending. So they're directing it specifically. So the last administration basically had an MMT mentality. They said, the more you borrow and spend, that's better for everybody. So let's just create a crazy amount of money and let's just spend it on anything. It doesn't even matter if it has a return on investment. They're like, let's just ship money to over to Africa and whatever, you know, and we don't have to get into any of that. But the Trump administration is very different. They're like, this is a wartime mentality. We are in desperate need of things like rare earths, and we need more energy production, and we need AI data centers, and we need more military capabilities. So we're going to borrow a lot of money and we're going to funnel it specifically into these different areas. And so what you notice if you tease apart the manufacturing PMI is that it's all going into these specific areas. Basically, AI, data centers, energy, and military related things are driving the whole economy right now. And all of the rest of US manufacturing is still languishing and is actually still in contraction. But the positive effect is so strong that it's pulling the entire sector higher, which is generally bullish. Why are we not seeing this in Bitcoin being reflected in the price? I would say one, because liquidity actually isn't expanding as fast as it normally would. Going back to Michael Howell's work, it's actually sort of contracting at the moment from a rate of change perspective. And number two, the government is funneling all available efforts and liquidity into these sectors. So Bitcoin just isn't one of the important things right now, right? As far as the government is concerned, it's saying we need to put it in the military, we need to put it into energy production, we need to put it into data centers. And so those things are just crushing it right now. And they're actually driving the whole stock market higher as well, those companies that are affiliated with that.
Yeah.
And everything else is languishing, including Bitcoin right now.
Yeah, lots of points to unpack there, but you're exactly right. I mean, that's also what you can see in these Brett's charts that people usually show, you know, when they're looking at the S&P 500 and stuff, and they're pointing out that it's just a couple of stocks, you know, driving all the performance. That's exactly that, you know, that it's that all the money and capital is sort of funneled into these selective industries, and it keeps everything afloat because they're so demanding and also so strategically important right now. But then, I mean, to your point about the ISM, I mean, that's also quite interesting, but you said it yourself. I mean, it looks to be like, I mean, remember James Jack, he shared this very interesting chart, you know, where it was like a very eerie correlation between SMI and Bitcoin. Always when it was above 50, it could go on these massive runs, you know, and that was sort of the explanation why it didn't go on a massive run in the last bull cycle, so to say. But then again, yeah, you're right. I mean, in the end, it needs to be focus of this money, you know. It doesn't just help that we're now way above 50 again. I mean, if the money isn't funneled into Bitcoin in that sense, it might not benefit that much from it, you know? And there, maybe I would like to get your take, because a lot of people thought when Trump originally came into office, and it's maybe a bit of tangent here, but they thought like, okay, he's really all in on Bitcoin. You know, he talked about the Bitcoin strategic reserve, all these things. And nowadays it's like nothing has come to fruition, and not a lot of this money now seems to be funneling into Bitcoin. Was it all just to gain the voters, and Bitcoin just still doesn't have a use case for them, which might be the case, as some argued? Or how do you think about this? You know, it was kind of like, yeah, disappointing in that sense.
Yeah. So it's disappointing, but not surprising to me personally. Mm-hmm. And I think to a lot of people. I mean, if it caught, just being honest, that Trump and his people in office with him, the cabinet, are, they say they're pro Bitcoin, but I think of them as they're basically all a bunch of crypto bros, and kind of the worst meaning of that. So they say, yes, I'm pro Bitcoin, but then they push the crypto agenda and the proof of stake agenda. And that's, to me, basically almost 100% nonsense and gambling. And then on top of that, they're really pushing the stablecoin agenda, which I think they have a good reason for that. They realize that they need to borrow just ghastly amounts of money. They need to create way more debt, and probably short-term debt in the near future, to fund all of these war efforts. And one of the places where it can go to in a sizable amount is into stablecoin. So when people, you know, buy Tether or Circle, USDC, whatever they have, when Tether or Circle, this is for you, I know you know this, but this is for the audience. So when Tether or Circle creates a USDC or USDT stablecoin, what they do is they take the dollars you send them and they create that coin and give that to you, that token. And then they basically buy short-term treasuries and they get to keep the interest on that. So it's a fantastic business model. Like, they just gush money. It's just unbelievable how much free cash flow these guys have for how few employees they have, especially. It's a great business model. I don't think it will last much longer. And that's part of what the Clarity Act is like. Should they, you know, be able to collect that high of interest rates when they do that? And should they be able to offer interest rates to clients and all these different things that they're arguing about right now in Congress? That is just one of that's the reason why Scott Bessent and other people in the Trump cabinet are promoting stablecoins, is because they will be massive buyers of massive amounts of US debt that's coming, and it's coming soon. So they're not true Bitcoiners. Some of them are, they understand it, but it's just not a priority at all for them in any way. So they say they have the strategic Bitcoin reserve, which is basically Bitcoin they stole or took or confiscated or whatever you want to say. Like, it could, you know, legally, yes, it was legally that they took it. But is that fair or just, or that's a whole different conversation. They are not stockpiling Bitcoin, which a lot of Bitcoiners had assumed, but many of us were very skeptical of that, because you just listen to these guys talk, and they're basically crypto bros. Like, you don't have your own coin and say you're a Bitcoiner. Yeah. Like, that's just, they're antithetical to each other. So,
yeah. No, you're right. And if you think from Trump's perspective, you know, for us Bitcoiners, like, he's currently thinking about how to beat China in the race of whatever is going on, you know. And there, obviously, he needs the rare earth. He needs that stuff to make his own military equipment and everything. And in that sense, you feel like, okay, Bitcoin doesn't help him to that much of an extent. Yeah, we Bitcoiner would argue, you know, if you keep enough Bitcoin further down the line, and you're the government with the biggest stack, you know, you will be the strongest maybe in a few years' time. But maybe Donald Trump again is like, we don't have time for a few years' time. You know, I need to act in the here and now. And so, yeah, I also was kind of intrigued by this idea and found it interesting. But then one part of me was always kind of skeptical. Maybe with every Bitcoiner it was the case. You know, you were sort of fascinated that this is now being talked about by the biggest leaders on the planet. But now you knew always all along the way, it might be a little sketchy, you know, and it will not turn out the way you might think it will. But I mean, you know, it is interesting. What's happening. One thing that I wanted to bring up, because we've been talking about Michael Howell, you know, I recently listened to another podcast of his where he was talking about this idea that he's also seeing this transitioning phase going on, you know, back to a booming real economy. But then he was like, he could actually be bad for risk assets in the meantime or in the transitioning phase, because he feels like liquidity is being withdrawn from the financial markets out into the real economy, you know, and it can't be in both places at once. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts on this as well. Maybe in the long term, it's also, well, it's good for Bitcoin, but then in the transitioning phase, how do you think about this?
I actually agree completely with that. I think liquidity can't be in two places at once. And so far, what's been driving public equities higher is what we talked about earlier, right? So a lot of that money is being funneled into specific tech companies, AI-related and energy-related companies and data center companies, and they're basically propelling the entire stock market higher right now. So it's very low market breadth, which generally is not a good sign. I will say that the whole AI movement is a real phenomenon, and it has real impacts that also throws a wrench into the kind of normal cyclical patterns. As more and more businesses, small businesses, medium-sized businesses embrace AI, and even these large, we're seeing like Google, Microsoft, Facebook, they're firing tens of thousands of their employees right now. And that's continuing on, and we're continuing to see like this white collar job loss, which is very real. So the market is recovering, but it's generally a jobless recovery. The upside of that is that businesses' operating margins are basically going through the roof right now. Their earnings are their earnings are expanding significantly. Forward earnings projections are continuing to go much higher. And again, I believe that's mostly the effects of AI. And why is that? Because one of the largest costs for most businesses is just paying for their employees, paying for people. And so if you can get rid of 5% or 10% or 50% of your employees, and you're the remaining shareholders, the C-suite, and you're sitting there like, oh my gosh, now we can do the same amount of work with half the employees. Our margins are going through the roof. Our earnings are going through the roof. And people who pay attention to that stuff, those earnings tend to drive the movements of stocks over the long run. So that's the one wrench in this, is that even though normally what you see in this type of season is when the liquidity shifts from being funneled into the stock market to being funneled into the real economy, as Michael Howell talks about, you generally see a weak performance for the stock market. And this often, by the way, happens in these midterm election years in the US. So every 4 years, you tend to have weakness and you tend to see bear markets in risk assets and in Bitcoin as well, while the underlying economy actually does pretty well. So there's sort of that delayed effect for the economy. And all of those things are like cyclical with each other. But this time around, what's interesting is because the effects of AI are real and because margins are increasing and earnings projections are increasing, we're actually seeing a continued move higher in the stock market. I think that's super interesting. And I think that's just showing how the way AI is actually also changing the world. And this is a real deal. Like, this tool is extremely powerful for humanity and it has real lasting effects, I think. And so that may be why we actually see, like, we're not supposed to see the stock market do well this year, but because of these sorts of things and because the government is funneling so much fiscal stimulus into this sector, that may be enough to actually propel the stock market and risk assets in general to kind of higher highs this year.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely right. I mean, the world is changing, and I mean, that's what I find so interesting, you know, coming back to the example you gave with COVID, you know, that things got distorted, you know, and then the real economy and the financial economy were yanked out of whack, and kind of like, okay, we're now going back to normal, so to say. But then you said it yourself, we have the entire AI backdrop, you know, with this sort of distortive as well in that sense, you know, because it's just turning things upside down, you know. Then I guess the whole thing which is happening now with the war is just a symptom, you know, but what Trump is trying to do is really end globalization in a sense of like reordering trade flows. He wants to go back to sovereigns taking over supply chains so they have the sovereignty that they need and stuff like this. And so I feel like, are we moving into this world where we will have more of these like big distortions, you know? And yeah, how do you think about this going forward? Will we have a world, you know, which is multipolar? The chaos will be higher by definition. At the same time, a lot of fiscal spending, which then helps to prop up markets, but then like the real economy will still sort of struggle because of it. There's so many moving pieces. Yeah, maybe you can help us put them together.
Well, sure. I can give you my opinions, which many of them will be wrong, obviously. But so I'm a big adherent of the fourth turning concept, and I'm sure you know about that as well. I think we are getting close to the climax of the of a fourth turning. And so I believe so, again, for people who in the audience who don't know about it, basically all of history moves in cycles, or you can think in it moves in sine waves. And we're at the point, and Ray Dalio, by the way, also talks about this, but he uses a different language or a different vernacular. He talks about big debt cycles. And what's super interesting about Ray Dalio, who's one of the more famous hedge fund managers and more successful hedge fund managers throughout history, he notices basically the exact same patterns that happen. And so what happens economically is that governments reach this point where they have borrowed so much money and they're so over indebted that basically the system starts to collapse on itself. And I do this because what happens is, like, after a war, there's basically very income equality is as tight as it ever is. But as you get further and further away from that, basically the resetting, the fourth turning, income inequality grows to basically intolerable levels. And that's where we are right now. Like the wealthy Americans, mostly, and wealthy people in the world are so exceedingly wealthy, and the poorest of the poor are so exceedingly poor, relatively speaking. And that's important because in general, the poor are still doing a lot better than the poor was doing 100 years ago or 200 years ago. Everyone understands that. But the relative difference gets to be intolerable for most people. And so basically the system can't support itself anymore, and it has to change, and it usually collapses, and it's usually violent, and it's usually brought about by wars and basically global disorder as this whole new world starts to be created. So to your point, I think absolutely that's a part of what's happening right now. I think this global US hegemony that we've had, where we've been the nation's basically military force or police force, an economic force for the last 80 years or so, I think is starting to come to an end. And I actually think, to their credit, the current administration recognizes that. And so I think part of what we're doing in the Middle East right now is we're basically trying to hand off the Middle East to the rest of to Europe and to Western allies in the region and to the Gulf Coast allies in that region. They're like, we want to keep this open so that for the next, 80 years of history, this will be on kind of at least in our friends' back pocket, but we won't be monitoring it as much. So I think the U.S. is pulling back. I think globalization has absolutely peaked and is rolling over, and we're moving to a more kind of fractured world. And I don't have to get into that too much, like the whole Monroe Doctrine and the U.S. focusing on the Western Hemisphere and basically leaving China to kind of deal with the Eastern Hemisphere in this new multipolar world. I think that's how we're moving too. I think the U.S. is going to focus more on its own hemisphere going forward, and we're doing things to prepare for that going forward. And so that has a huge impact on everything. And the reason why it matters from an investing standpoint is because we don't have the money. So we're already massively over indebted. Like, our debt to GDP ratios are basically at historically high levels right now. And we haven't even gotten into a major war yet, which is troubling to me. So we don't have real money or sound money to pay for all of this. This leads back to, why aren't we building a strategic Bitcoin reserve? Why aren't we buying a ton of gold? Why aren't we just, buying all of these things to build up our infrastructure? Part of it is because we don't have sound money enough to do that. We have to basically borrow everything, or we have to get our allies to basically invest in our country, because they actually hold most of the assets in our country. So we actually need them to invest here in America in order for us to build all of that stuff. And it's kind of an awkward situation to be in right now. And so what that portends to is, I think, going forward, based on how richly valued U.S. stocks are and how heavily indebted the United States is, in general, when you get to periods like this in history, hard assets and sound money tend to outperform financialized assets in the United States. And I think we're right in the early innings of that right now.
Which then kind of leads me to my last question, BTC, which for us Bitcoiners, obviously, it's a hard asset. It's the hardest assets ever existed or that has ever existed. But then if you look into the broader market, and you said it on Danny's shows as well, I mean, and if you manage money on a daily basis, you know this, a lot of the market is not viewing Bitcoin as a hard asset. It's looking at it as if it was just another tech stock, or software affiliation or whatever. And so my kind of question is, like, Bitcoin is in this tricky position state, where you would, if I could choose, I would rather say, let's go on as we have in the last 17 years, we had like a things were still going okay. You know, nobody was talking about the whole system is changing. You know, you want to have this booming economy, as you said, mild inflation above nominal inflation rates, you know, which lowers real interest rates, which is kind of good for Bitcoin. And it's just chugging along just well, you know, and now, but because I also am of the firm belief that globalization, all these global trade flows and everything, they have created a lot of the liquidity that has supported asset valuations in the last few years, you know. And if all of this is reversed, I'm just asking myself, even though deep down I know Bitcoin will survive and it's made for these times, but when and how will the world recognize it? Because currently they're not seeing it as such, you know.
So that's a lot of questions, but in a lot of good points. So how I look at Bitcoin, I'm a believer in, I think the power law model is the best way to think about Bitcoin and its growth over time in whatever denominator you use, whether it's dollars or other fiat or a Swiss franc or the euro or, you know, pick your currency, you know, current or past currency or gold, you can price it in gold, any of those things. I think it generally will continue to follow the power law model until it doesn't. And so for people who are familiar, you can look up Bitcoin power law and you can look at charts of it. And it doesn't predict a specific price, but it does predict a trajectory and usually within some band lines. And you can see that it sort of does this, flops up and down in between these band lines as they go up and down. Here's how I look at it as a fund manager. When global liquidity is moving in the wrong direction, like it's decelerating, like I would suggest it's kind of doing right now, when manufacturing and just the general economy is weak or contracting. So when you're in a bear market in general, you're going to see this hang out at the lower bound of this trajectory of this power law channel. That's where we are right now. And why does it do that? So some people look at that and they say, oh my gosh, it's going to fall out of this channel and it's going to go to zero because it has no intrinsic value. And they'll say, you know, nonsense like that. All the people pass their FUD, their fear, uncertainty, and doubt. But what it gets down to when you're at the bottom of the channel is it's you and me and the Bitcoiners watching this who simply think of, they already understand what Bitcoin is. They're not like Wall Street that thinks it's a software stock. They're not crypto bros who are, you know, hoping to get rich quick. They're basically people who understand that it's the best form of money, that like gold is a great form of money. It was the best form of money in the analog age for thousands of years. But now Bitcoin came along and it's the best form of money in the new digital age. And so the lower end of this bound of this power law, when Bitcoin gets close to that price, which it is right now, I would say the lower bound of that is kind of in the $50,000 to $60,000 range right now. The reason why I don't think it's going to go below that and stay below that for any long period of time is because there are tons of people who just see Bitcoin as savings. It's a better form of money. They don't care about the fluctuations. They don't care about geopolitics. They don't care about technical indicators. They just, every time they get paid every 2 weeks, they buy some Bitcoin or they have a daily dollar cost average and they establish that baseline. And then so flipping all that on its head, when liquidity is booming again and when the economy is booming again and when everybody's not freaking out about a war or who knows what's going on and oil isn't spiking to 150, you know, and maybe it's back down to more reasonable levels, then Bitcoin will be free to get more speculative again. So in this band that's going up, it'll start going to the top end of that band or at least the upper half of that band. And everybody will talk about how it's amazing and you can get rich quick if you own it and blah, 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 all the things that people do when they get excited about bull markets. We'll know at that point that it's just a lot of froth and speculation and leverage priced into the price. And that is probably going to at some point correct again during the next bear market and come down to the bottom of that channel. So I think the truth in all of that power law stuff and in these channels is that you don't really know what the price is of Bitcoin, the base fundamental price, when the buyers of last resort, those of us that are just dollar cost averaging and treating it like savings, that's when it rides along the bottom end of that channel. And I think that channel will hold on the downside indefinitely.
Yeah, in the end, like all I'm hearing, not to kind of diminish what you're saying, but is like, don't overthink, you know, in terms of like, if the world is changing, as you said, there are more and more of these last resort buyers, you know, with BTC as well, because more and more people are figuring it out and feel like, okay, now it kind of, they came for the money, but then kind of stayed for the revolution. And ever since, I see that asset flourish in that sense. But yeah, That's amazing. So thanks a lot for throwing in these great insights here. Maybe given you're not on social media nowadays, if people want to still follow your work and kind of reach out, how can they do so, if at all?
Yeah. So yeah, don't look for me on social media. I still have a Nostr account, but I don't use it very often. And I always like to say this public service announcement. If you see me anywhere else on social media, it's not me. It's an imposter. There's tons of imposters out there. So please don't fall for any scams. I'm mostly just on Substack these days. So I started this newsletter. It's called Dr. Jeff's Macro Chartbook, which is kind of a mouthful. But you can find me over on Substack, and you know, there's great discussions happening right there. It's not full of bots and spam yet. So you can learn a lot over there. There's a lot of people I follow and I subscribe to on Substack that are very good and very informative. And so if you feel like you're doom scrolling and wasting your time on social media and you're in a bad mood all the time, come over to Substack and check it out, because at least it's probably the purest form of, I guess it's social media still, but it's, you do a lot of learning over there, and it's very good.
No, I can subscribe to this. That's definitely true. We have a Substack as well. We follow many people and it's amazing. And so we'll link to yours as well for sure. Make sure people can check it out. And so Jeff, thanks a lot for coming on, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Hey, thank you. You as well. Thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you. Bye, Jeff.